Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I am Bryce Castillo, your de facto host?
Your perpetual host. You've always been the host.
I've always been the host.
Yeah, you will always be the host.
That's Brian Brushwood.
Hello.
And Justin Robert Young.
Well, hi, friends. How are you?
Good. How are you guys doing? We're all coming back from the big game, the very big game.
The large contest, as it's called.
The incredibly big footballs.
The most dangerous game.
Well, speaking of dangerous, I wanted to jump right into a news story. You know, birds are generally pretty smart, right? I mean, we consider certain species of birds to be really smart.
Yeah, you got like ravens and crows. In fact, there's a scheme I read about like a couple weeks ago where they would set up these stations that had computer ID things that had cameras and could understand whether or not a cigarette butt was placed in them. And so basically you would train the local bird populace to exchange cigarette butts for food tokens. So,
really?
Yeah. So, and I was so pleased because like I had that idea, I 20 years ago, I was thinking like, why don't we genetically modify ants to be obsessed with picking up cigarette butts? Or I guess nowadays you don't quite see them quite so often, but they call it the crowbar.
The crowbar from crowded cities. I actually read a report about this a few months ago. This is ingenious. They put these devices out and they train the local population to understand, you know, cigarette butts lead to food. Put the cigarette butts here, you get food out of it. And it's really ingenious.
Plus, also, you get the extra benefit of knowing that every time someone goes out to smoke, all these crows are going to show up and just stare judgingly. like, you going to drop that? You going to drop that? What are you doing? What are you doing?
That's amazing. I guess really the only thing would be if you, I mean, you got to make sure that you're throwing all those cigarette butts out. Huh?
Yeah. It's like, do the responsible thing. Don't deny the birds the right to eat. Throw your cigarette butts on the ground like a civilized human. Let the lesser beings pick it up.
Until some chain smoker decides they're going to be king of the crows by like just putting their own cigarette butts in.
Oh, people feeding the crows butts.
I would like to believe that at a concert, the chain smokers are like, everybody, throw them on the ground. The crows will do our bidding.
As the chain smokers
go
speak.
Go feed the crows!
So that's kind of a man-made, invention, this crowbar idea of taking crows, intelligence and
leveraging. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah. In Australia, they've actually found documented reports, or there become more documented reports of birds, Australian raptors, as this Cosmos magazine article claims, or calls them, will actually start fires.
How do birds start fires?
Well, in most of these instances, it is the birds taking lit kindling.
Oh, taking existing fire and much like ancient man before they figured out the trick of rubbing sticks. To take a stick that's on fire, take it somewhere else, spread.
Yeah, like Bob Gosford, an ornithologist, usually black kites, sometimes brown falcons, will pick up a firebrand or stick not much bigger than your finger and carry it away to an unburnt area of grass and drop it there to start a new fire. A lot of the uses for the birds to do this has been to corner prey and to, you know, limit movement and get prey into their...
That's heavy duty. Yeah. And I guess it makes sense. Like, even a bird could figure out, hey, you ever notice that when there's a fire around, all these mice, like, freak out and just sort of stand there, and they're really easy to pick up and pluck from above?
They are pattern-recognizing creatures. There is no doubt about it. To train a bird is literally just to continue to give it the right stimulus, and they will continue to do whatever you want, you know?
And not only are they using that to hunt prey, in some instances, their methods have been shown to be acting as fire control to try to limit fire damage, not just
okay, that,
to her prey.
That sounds a little bit more far-fetched to me.
Alex Kasselnick, an expert on animal tool use, says many species have learned to respond to natural fire by escaping from it or exploiting it to hunt fleeing prey, but these hawks are showing a form of fire control. This is the first he has heard of this non-human animal.
So they're setting like control burns to make sure that the fire doesn't get too outlandish.
I mean, that's what it sounds like, right?
Yeah, it's incredible. Now, apparently, the imagery of birds taking and lighting things on fire has been an image in Australia for a very long time. I'm trying to see here. Aborigines people have dreaming fire ceremonies. The Lorcan and the Yabudurua ceremonies from the Arnhem Land region.
What now?
which incorporates scenes involving the reenactment of birds spreading fires from places to places. So this is not only a very, you know, strong use of pattern recognition and problem solving, but it's also a problem or a situation that has existed for apparently a very long time.
So, I mean, it's not for me to doubt the methods of scientists, mm-hmm. but as I'm trying to wrap my mind, I could very easily picture a bird understanding whenever there's smoke and fire around, prey is really easy to grab. I can get that. But that preemptive, like a bird being around long enough to say, you ever notice that when a bunch of fires are going, they rage out of control, but if there are smaller fires around that they form a barrier?
The wording on this is maybe a little weird, you know, showing a form of fire control.
So maybe it's purely instinctual. They're not really thinking it through.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. I don't think that they're like, let's make sure this fire doesn't get too big. I think that it's just they found the most effective way to do this, and
or it could be very localized in terms of protecting a nest.
If you think of a particular, say, you know, 1,000 hectares as an independent ecosystem, that system compared to other 1,000 hectare systems, that one where the birds are touched in such a way that they feel this compulsion to start tiny fires to surround the big fire tends to survive and do better than the other one.
Yeah. Apparently, the Aboriginal groups in Australia have known about this idea and have spoken about it. I mean, we've just mentioned that it's been a part of their imagery. From this Cosmos Magazine article, European scientists, however, have shown a reluctance to accept the observation of Aboriginal Australians, which explains why the seemingly widespread behavior has not been scientifically documented until now.
And even that makes sense, too, right? Because
people are racist.
Exactly. I mean, that's what I'm thinking. Like Western scientists are probably going to have prejudices that cause them to be all like...
Well, I mean, it doesn't appear that, you know, these Aboriginals have had a peer-reviewed demonstration of this firebird.
Speaking of which, who are their peers? Wallabies, I submit. Maybe a kangaroo next.
The koalas.
Take one, Dr. Racist.
So this is the beginning of this report. A lot of what's happening now is going out and getting these stories from people who live out in the northern parts of Australia, where most of these reports are coming out of. What do you guys think the next step in terms of this overall scientific research is?
I mean, I guess really the short-term benefit is to reinforce what Justin was saying at the beginning, which is birds are pretty clever pattern-recognizing creatures. And I mean, as with any other discovery, the next step is to figure out how that makes money for me, humanity. How's that good for me?
Exactly. The next step is the Friday email blast from Modern Rogue about how to train your bird to light fires.
Yeah. What do you think, Justin?
This is very likely, and beyond just saying that, you know, academics are racist, you know, this is, I mean, some of these parts of Australia are not, you know, easy to get to, nor is this kind of behavior easy to track. If it's just like, hey, every once in a while, birds do this thing. Like, that's kind of a hard thing to know exactly where this kind of behavior is going to happen. So I would hope that we just did more to do it, because when you watch, I mean, there are just even like YouTube videos of like birds solving problems that will blow your mind. Like, you know, there's definitely any kind of species that is very often prey and therefore has to be very, very clever, you know, which many birds are, I think will surprise you when you look at like what their capacity for problem solving is.
Yeah. Do you think Dr. Bird could like put out like a small fire?
Yeah,
Dr. Bird.
How much smarter do you think Dr. Bird is than you give him or her credit for?
I mean, they have a PhD.
Yeah. Well, he does. Yeah, he is Dr. Bird. There is no denying that. Well, I mean, I would say it's hard to say that we underestimate him since we fawn over this tiny little cockatiel. But like, I do think that if like we've gotten to the point now where I've got him trained to kind of like fly to me when I want him to. And I know, or at least I believe I know, where he is showing intelligence in just not wanting to deal with me. And like, I know when he's either scared or compliant, obviously, because he flies to me, or, and this is where I'm probably reading in my own, I'm assigning my own human emotions to him, where I just think he's like, no, not right now.
Mm. Well, so this is something that shortly before he passed away, Michael Crichton would give speeches talking about how bad we are at predicting complex systems. And he was talking about it in terms of the environment. But one of the examples he gives is anybody who has had a toddler understands the unpredictability of predictive capabilities when it comes to complex systems, because you can do everything exactly the same as you tell a kid to you know, go wipe their behind or clean up their room or whatever. Yeah. And for
completely different results.
Looks like identical setup conditions, just those whatever tiny little thing, time of day, what he watched last night or whatever, will completely shape a different outcome.
One of the researchers says that their next steps will be actually setting controlled fires with the help of Aboriginal land managers to try to capture footage of the avian firebugs in action. They're actually going to try and see if they can get, you know,
man, what a wild thing. So you start with the legends, and then you have to get eyes, you know, boots on the ground, eyes on the scene to verify the legends. And actually, now you have to capture, because none of that matters. We all know that we're all flawed wetware, and that somebody could show up at a bird conference and say, I seen it, that bird. He said he was heroic. He was a hero. That's probably not the best presentation at the ornithology convention.
I seen it.
That bird.
Please get off the stage. Dr. Racist is up next.
Dr. Racist is up.
Well, I think it's an absolute waste.
but then not only do you have to catch it, but then you think about how many years it's going to take to continue to set up these things, because any one example won't be statistically significant. You got to do... You know, like, you got to start 100 fires and show that more often than would be expected by chance, birds go around setting preventative fires to keep them contained.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. when fire, like, the end of this article actually makes a really interesting point. Up until now, humans and lightning have been regarded as the only vectors of fire in Australia. But now there's, quote, cause to re-examine our understanding of fire history and how fire works in the landscape.
I mean, well, the concept of resistance to fire is what is all.
There we go. We did it.
Well, wait a minute. Okay, so wait. So they're saying, but these birds aren't starting the fires, right? So there is a fire, and then they are using that fire to go set other fires.
Right. Also, they're not singing about how they did not start the fire. There's not bird song that goes cheep, 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 cheep. Chippy, 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 chippy.
A very long bird song. A very, very long.
That's the part of Snow White they don't show you.
Chippy, 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 Marilyn Monroe. Yeah. Oh.
Vietnam War.
So apparently we know that they're taking them to unburnt areas. We don't. I guess part of this will be discovering how far away they're spreading these existing fires. So, it'll be interesting to see how this shakes out.
That's interesting. That's another behavior that I could see is, imagine birds knowing that it's useful to have, lacking the ability to start a fire on their own. I could see them evolving to become good stewards of fire, where we're like, oh, hey, that's a fire. That's a real useful thing because you could drop a branch and it scares up all the mice. Mm-hmm. So instinctually, we know that if this fire
is time to attack.
Basically, I know if we just watch, this fire is going to go out. So take some of these twigs and constantly keep tending. Keep a fire lit at all times, right?
Oh, interesting.
Which is the way I would do it because I can't start a fire.
Yeah.
No.
So you would just find a fire naturally occurring and then continue
to spread it around.
That's why it takes so long for the magic show to prep. You have to wait for a fire to.
I have to wait for a naturally occurring fire before I could light that first torch, and then I come over. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, that sounds like a real hardship. The kind of hardship that you can help keep us out of by donating to patreon.com/weirdthings. Now, a lot of you have told us over the years, hey, how can I share my wealth with you? Well, we finally have answers.
And a lot of you are loaded. We understand. It's a challenging burden. You've worked hard and you've achieved your success, and you want to know how you can spread that wealth around. Well, we have something for you.
It's called Patreon. Weirdthings.com. Patreon.com/weirdthings. That's where you need to go. Go ahead and kick us whatever you have. You got a dollar? Give us a dollar. You have $5,000? Give us all of them. Why not? I mean, you only live once.
And you can give it to us up front. You don't have to wait,
Yeah, a lot of people will insist, $5,000, let's spread it out over the next 10 years. Not us. We're flexible. We're flexible, and we're willing to accept all you want to give.
Remember the old Weird Things motto, give us your money.
Give us your money, and we'll talk about birds.
If you decide to give us a dollar, you'll get early access to our sister show After Things, all about being a creative professional, and you'll get a special green color in our Discord, nightattack.tv/discord. It looks very nice. It's a very nice green.
It is.
Yeah.
Dude, it's pretty great. And thank you to everybody who does support us. It is awesome, awesome, awesome that you guys care about independent science content.
Yeah, every time it's a new month, you hit that bump where a bunch of people remember, oh, wait, I'm spending money? I'm Mr. Don't Spend Moneyton. I don't spend money. And then they
why
cancel.
Why did I even make an account?
Yeah. Well, how did I end up on Patreon?
How did I get
Patreon?
In the system? I went very far before I realized what I was doing.
Moneyton. I don't know. It makes me
what
so happy.
Curious. Curiosity. I don't spend money, and yet here I am spending money.
I'm going to call my friend Dr. Racist and have a conversation about this. Why am I spending money? I'll tell you, it really warms my heart how so many people are supporting independent creators. It's really great.
Man, there's a lot more voices when Andrew isn't on the show. Andrew is the restrictor cap.
He's the restraining bolt on the droids. All of a sudden we go BB-8 and become a miscreant.
Yeah. As soon as Andrew's gone, it's just all
gentlemen, do you know about humanzees? Have you heard of the term
please
humanzees?
Please don't make these be what they sound like they are. I know that chimpanzee are our closest kissing cousins in the environment or the tree of life. I know that we share 99.5% DNA with them. And I'm terribly afraid you're about to introduce an episode of the Island of Dr. Moreau here.
Me too.
So you guys might remember from the 70s, Oliver the Chimp. Do you remember Oliver the Chimp?
No, I remember Nim, who learned language, allegedly, and Coco knows language. I don't know this one.
Wait a minute. Who was that CD World? All I saw was an ad on the side of that. What? The CD World of... Oh,
this is more Sun. This is from the Sun article. We're trying
you
to
will know them by the company they upright. Keep. The quality of the articles. Right next to We'll Sleep Together, the CD world of sex for rent.
Sure. No, we're talking about chimpanzees. So in the 70s, there was a chimp named Oliver who, based on, you know, his propensity to stand upright, and he had sort of a flatter face and a more, you know, the pointed nose, people believed he might be the first chimpanzee, a missing link between human and chimpanzee.
Okay, but the problem, and I'm sure we're about to dive in and you'll bring all this up. This is one of the miscommunications or the misidentifications of creationists, is that they seem to feel like I didn't come from no chimpanzee, but it's like, no, but humans and chimpanzees very likely had an ancestor that bridged the gap between them. So I guess I'm curious how it could be that a chimpanzee would morph so close to, you know, you don't see those lateral changes. You see lineage.
Yeah. Well, and to finish off the story of Oliver, he rose to prominence in the idea that he was a missing link or a chimpanzee, a mixture of a human and a chimpanzee in the 70s. And then in, I want to say, the early 2000s, geneticists did a test and found out that he was just a chimpanzee with
that happened to stand up.
Yeah.
Right.
Basically. So apparently a new report is coming out now. Gordon Gallup, who came up with the term chimpanzee, claims that a former university professor told him that a chimpanzee was successfully created in the 20s and then was killed by the doctors who birthed it.
Okay. Forgive me if this is uncouth, but 100 years ago, I would only imagine, shall we say, more rudimentary methods to blend two different species than nowadays.
I was young and I needed the money.
Dr. Racist, what are you doing?
It was a different world, a different time.
Well, and it was, in a quote.
Oh, hold on, wait a minute. Before we get into the details on this, and whatever this crackpot is saying, 100 years ago, 1920, there was the drive to crossbreed a human and a chimpanzee.
Oh man, I want to say that there's even stories or legends of like it being a Nazi super soldier campaign. Like
This is two decades before or a decade and a half before
Indiana Jones.
Indiana Jones.
as part of this article, the most infamous chimpanzee project was conducted by a Russian biologist, Ilya Ivanov, also in the 1920s, who tried and failed to create a Soviet super soldier using human sperm and female chimps.
Okay, first of all, great name. Olva Ivanov, what was it?
Ilya Ivanov.
Yeah, it might as well be Ivanov. Okay. We must stop Dr. Ivanov and his plans to create super soldiers, yeah. Dr. Racist, to me! He flies. I see you've evolved wings, Dr. Racist.
They'll finally get the respect of those aboriginals.
If you can't beat them, join them, I say. It's the third act. It's time for transformation.
Super Saiyan Dr. Racist.
Is this your final form?
Back to my ivory tower, extra white.
But yeah, so there are various reasons for trying to just prove the hybridization between chimpanzee and human, including this study. They inseminated a female chimpanzee with human semen from an undisclosed donor and claimed not only that pregnancy occurred, but the pregnancy went full term and resulted in a live birth.
Oh boy, let's unpack this. Number one, what are the odds that this is factually accurate?
Also, what are the odds that the 1920s really were roaring? Holy crap. Like,
The new rage, the Human Z, is coming to a city near you.
Could your job be replaced by the Human Z? We go to famed Dr. Racist.
They'll be winning all the dance contests.
So, yeah, there's questions about this. This is a story. This is
We're in the monkey. We've got a lot of what it takes to make humansies. Sorry.
So this is a third-hand report. This is from a gentleman from Gordon Gallup, who says that a professor of his worked at a research facility where this occurred. So this is third-hand knowledge at this point.
Well, here, like, in support of this, we can understand that the world that they are discussing was far, far different, obviously, than our own in terms of, like, an urban legend then could have just been an urban legend. Like, there's far less ways that we can verify things were real then than we can now, right?
I mean, also let's acknowledge that part of the strength, I'm using air quotes, of this story is that, you know, we've seen insane kind of crossovers. You know, a liger is a real thing. A lion and a tiger having sex, you know, and
mules.
It's a donkey and
a horse?
Yeah, a donkey and a horse.
Yeah.
And granted, you know, what you get is, you know, sterile and not right. I don't know that I could push it entirely out of the realm of possibility that this could actually happen. I'm not comfortable with the thought.
Yeah,
the missing piece was, for no pun intended, just the idea that there was this drive in that period of medical history. There was a sense that, like, trying to explore the fringes of our biology by creating new species.
Yeah. His quote continues, in a matter of days or a few weeks, they began to consider the moral and ethical considerations, and the infant was euthanized.
I mean, that also sounds like...
That's shady.
Perfectly on-the-nose storytelling to wrap up a ghost story as... You know, yeah. to make the lack of evidence for the thing, like, you know, and because they were so ashamed, think about it. Have you ever heard of it? That's right. That's proof that it must have happened.
Another reported case also happened in Maoist China in 1967, where a female primate became pregnant with a human hybrid only to die from neglect after the lab scientists were forced to abandon the project following the outbreak of the Cultural Revolution.
I feel like we're starting to see some similarities in a lot of these stories where it's like, no, but for real, I do have a girlfriend in Canada. She just decided.
It's only because of the Cultural Revolution that, you know, we decided to call it quits. It was just too weird.
I sort of weighing the moral implications of my girlfriend in Canada. And ultimately, I decided that, you know. After going all the way, we couldn't stay together.
So this transitions a little bit into our next story. If you two worked at a research lab,
which we do, the Bri-Bri and Gerbs Foundation for a Better World.
Yes.
Asterisk, and the asterisk says a better world. To be defined per our charter coming spring 2019. Sure.
It's a very big keychain.
It's the Institute for a Very Big Keychain. So we're going to build it. It's going to be huge. And we're going to keep all of our keys on it.
If let's say, hypothetically, you were immunologists. You were studying...
Which we are. I keep telling you this.
Also,
vaccines cause autism. I've been saying that for years. That's a true fact that you can believe.
Yes, quite right. Me too.
Oh, Dr. Racist. Now, does it cause autism in all races?
Well, wink.
And let's say you were testing on some monkeys. Okay. You were treating them with diseases to try to.
It was giving them. It's not exactly treating them.
Well,
giving them diseases.
But you would, as you would give them vaccines to try to test.
Okay.
Immunology.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, I got you.
Sure. What if one of the monkeys escaped? How long of a monkey escaping capture
long enough to infect Kevin Spacey with whatever psycho bug makes him touch every. I'm talking about the movie Outbreak. Remember, he died in the movie Outbreak.
I'm acting like that's
why he became a monster is because he. Who, Dr. Racist? What's going on?
I love it. Seven still holds up.
But how long?
Oh, I didn't know you were such a cinephile, Dr. Racist.
I'm still able to watch K-Pax.
Now, did you mind that he was portraying a non-human in K-Pax?
Oh, well, I love Usual Suspects as well.
even though they had a racially and ethnically diverse cast.
Yeah, not my fave.
He's able to put aside his personal feelings.
Short lane, Spacey.
So, but how long of a test subject being escaped and potentially,
corrupting the outside world.
How long?
What kind of diseases are we talking about here? Where are we at?
Is it pimples? Were they trying to cure pimples? Because maybe that's okay. Maybe he's that lovable character who goes up and down Hollywood Boulevard, and if he gives you a kiss, you'll never have pimples again.
So I'll say that. No,
that old chestnut.
And like, oh, that's Mr. Chimpy.
Mr. Chimpy. Let him kiss you, honey.
So I'll say that this lawsuit does not name what diseases necessarily you were using on the monkeys.
Hold on. Are they suing the monkey? Who's suing who?
Well, so a former immunology professor from the University of Pittsburgh is actually suing the university for wrongful termination. Or whistleblower laws because
he spread the word that a monkey with a super cure for pimples had escaped.
There were two instances, one where a monkey and one where a rabbit escaped, and he was told not to write them up as exposure incidents.
So this is rabbit v monkey.
Yes. Rabbit v. Monkey.
Rabbit
Pokemon.
V. Wade.
God almighty. Apparently it was originally reported that, oh, well, they were out of the cage, but it was just for a little while. And then he blew the whistle and reported that, oh, it was actually for like kind of a few hours. And then the lawsuit is claiming that he's been treated unfairly since blowing the whistle.
So the story as he would tell it is that the university realizes that this is a major incident when something gets into an uncontrolled environment that has experimental disease vectors in it, and they would prefer that it all kind of just kept quiet. Yeah. And then meanwhile, he reported it as it was and feels maligned by the university.
Because it was also sort of on his watch, he just to get into the weeds a bit about this lawsuit,
the monkey was into weed.
his access to, quote, select agents, these diseases was restricted until he went orientation and training. And even after then, his access was not restored. He was unable to complete his research and was subsequently fired.
Did you say subsequently?
Subsequently?
Subsequently? I like subsequently. That's pretty good.
Subsequently seems like something that you'd be like, oh, geez, here's old subsequent again. Like, hey man, you know.
Most people do it sequently, but we're going to be more low-key than that. We're going to be subsequently. Be cool. Hey, man, let's keep it subsequent.
But
all right. So wait, hold on. Before we get off on the subsequent thing. All right. So, The one thing that I think that is kind of important to this story is realizing exactly how clicky all of this kind of research stuff is, that you are on a team and you're, professors and the leads are people that need to keep it together, because ultimately you are fighting against allocation of funding within your university. You are looking at grant research, stuff like that. There's a lot of politics that goes into things. And if something kind of doesn't go wrong, totally right, you want to make sure that there's an element of PR to it, that you're not putting your worst foot forward at the very least. And sometimes I think that can lead to maybe a little bit too much dirt being swept under the rug, and it becomes less PR and more outright lying.
Yeah. So if you were in this situation where you had a subject escape, how long, like, what is the 5-second rule for an infectious
I think
disease?
It's literally 5 seconds. Yeah. I think if it's been more than 5 seconds, which is like all of them, then you might have a responsibility to share some stuff.
And the key is, this guy wound up covering his own ass because he had to file the report, right?
Yeah.
And so the report was, this monkey was not infectious when he knew for a fact that it was, and, well, he was instructed. Do I have this story right? Or
I think he was responsible for the monkey getting out, but was told to not report it as an exposure incident by one of his higher ups. He was told to hide it.
Let's figure out a word for it that doesn't sound so damaging to all of our contributors and our reputation in academia or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So was he supposed to be saying that the monkey wasn't out at all, or the monkey was not infectious?
It sounds like I said, don't categorize it as an exposure event, because I'm sure there are animals that get loose, and I'm sure there are these things. And at some point you have to check a box.
Yeah.
Is this an exposure event? Should we call the CDC and tell them what we've been up to and explain that this thing's out there?
It says Cole took it upon herself to review the university's report of the incident and found what she called a, quote, notable error in the report, namely that the infected laboratory monkey had only escaped its cage for a short time when it had actually escaped for several hours.
But also, that's one of the brilliant things about this, is that a short time is a very amorphous definition. I mean, you know, if I'm going to go to Florida to see a launch of a rocket and come back, a few hours is a short time. If I am a diseased monkey released into the wild, you might think a few hours is not a short time.
And again, that's why I think that this is so interesting, because ultimately this dude effed up and wanted to be clean on how he effed up, and that would be damaging to the entire organization, and so he was told to shut up. And now I guess he's upset because everybody looks at him like a real snitch jamoke.
Yeah.
Snitch Jamoke. That's Dr. Racist's real name.
Christian name.
Oh, born to the Connecticut Jamokes.
We got another story here. I want to show you a picture of this headline from the USA Today.
All right. Oh, geez. We got some kind of critter. And it says here, in these waters, it's not good fish that are biting.
It's not good that fish are biting.
Oh, it's not good.
Justin, can you describe this image? Like,
there are, in this open fish's mouth, what look like human teeth.
That's right. It looks like human teeth, doesn't it?
Or chimpanzee teeth. Or
humanzee teeth.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying.
The humanzee screwed that fish? Maybe they didn't finish the job.
Apparently, this is not an abnormality. There's the paku fish, which is a
that has just human ass teeth.
Which has
my god!
It is similar to the piranha, though it grows much larger.
For the audio listeners, I want you to right now take a selfie of your lower set of teeth, or look in the mirror, or anything, And then just imagine that just flatly photoshopped onto an eel or some crap.
Yeah, its bottom row of teeth has about six or seven human-sized proportioned
and then
teeth.
Little tiny teeth beyond that.
That's right. This is God. This is the Paku fish. It was found in Arizona.
In Arizona?
It was found in Arizona.
What, just baking in the sun underneath a saguaro cactus?
No.
Saying, please, I swear I'm not a fish, please?
Not quite. It was in the Silver Bell Lake. It was fished out on the north side of the Silver Bell Lake, even though the Paku fish is a native to South America.
I think that's somebody's grandfather who went to Arizona to retire and just spent too much time swimming. And then the sun caught him unawares, shrank his body, but not his dentures. and my guess is he is quite a conversationalist.
That's a strong theory.
Okay, so Silver Bell Lake is in the far west coast of Arizona, bordering with California. Right by Lake Havasu and the Havasu National Wildlife Region. I got the wrong Silver Bell Lake.
I think this is correct, near Christopher Columbus Park in near Tucson.
So near Tucson. Okay. Oh, yeah. No. I had the wrong one. There's another thing. All right. So it's right by Tucson. Holy crap.
Yeah.
So that is in the south of Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Are these things what?
To be
what
feared?
Happened? What happened to these things, man? They got a fish with teeth. They got to get spoken and applying for mortgages.
We're all paying for braces next.
What's going on? Are these fish, they got teeth. Going to be going to the Sizzler ordering steaks.
They're all vote for Obama.
Oh, God. It's too late to do that.
Not for these fish. Yeah. These fish.
Well, how do you think a South American relative of the piranha arrives in a lake in southern Arizona?
Movies.
Oh, I'll bet you some eccentric weirdo was like, some drug lord is like, the piranha. That's how I murder all of my unfaithful employees.
No, dude, I'm convinced somebody was making a sequel to Piranha 2. They probably called it Piranha 2-2.
No piranhas.
More
this time.
Piranhas.
No, but they're not piranhas. They're fucking.
And then they brought it up, and then they had them in a tank, and they were supposed to flush it down the toilet. But then somebody, like a 7-year-old girl, was like, "Daddy, don't do it." And they're like, "Okay, I'll throw it in this lake instead. Nothing bad will come of this."
So this is definitely from the piranha family. But piranhas are not indigenous to that area at all, right?
No, unless they're retired piranhas.
I was going to say,
They're taking it easy.
Very reasonable retirement.
The dry air is great up there.
Great.
They love it.
For taxes.
That's Plus, I mean, real estate is it's coming back.
So I would suspect that, yeah, that this is some kind of weird mutation of an invasive species. Although if it were an invasive species, then you would have to imagine that the piranhas had some kind of run, there, unless somebody imported the Paku fish or whatever.
Mm. According to Mark Hart, a spokesman for the Arizona Game and Fish Department in Tucson, Game and Fish does not stock waterways with Paku fish. The ones that show up in community waters start off as pets that people dump into the lakes when they get too big to manage. Because even though they start off and are related to piranhas, they can grow up to be about 2 feet long.
Hold on. So people are buying these? I had never heard of this fish once in my life until literally right now. People are buying these toothy-ass fish and then tossing them in the lake?
Granted, the big difference is that you're not currently on meth or dealing, and you don't have any street cred to worry about establishing with exotic and strange killer fish.
Well, people buy them because they look like piranha. They will eat worms and small fish, but they mostly eat plants. So if you want to have what looks like a piranha.
Like a vegan piranha.
You would get a young Paku fish.
With a hell of a grin. Look you right in the eye. Like, yeah.
Okay, I just Googled Paku fish.
Uh-huh. And what'd you get?
And I got a Snopes article.
Uh-oh.
apparently there is a legend. The claim is that the red-bellied paku, an invasive species related to the piranha but with human-like teeth, is known to have bitten off a man's testicle.
I believe it.
But it only has one row of teeth, really.
You know what? That's a soft bit. I'm told.
You're not sure. No one really quite knows.
Well, apparently, here's what is true about it. The paku is a cousin of the piranha. And in 2001, one male swimmer was reportedly bitten on the genitals and one female swimmer on the leg by paku fish in Papua New Guinea. Both survived. But there's no documented instances of a paku fish biting a man's testicles off or anyone dying from a paku bite.
As my friend Dr. Racist likes to say, safe than sorry. Oh. Don't get in there.
Like, okay, I can agree with that.
Even a stop clock is right twice a day. I mean, granted, his was more racially motivated than mine.
You're damn right.
the regional aquatic wildlife program supervisor of Arizona Game and Fish said paku fish are on Arizona's restricted wildlife list of animals that cannot be owned without a permit. The problem is that people buy paku fish without permits, and the people selling paku fish don't know the wildlife laws or that they need permits. You can also buy paku fish online, where no one's going to
check. At our newest sponsor, pakufish.org. Use promo code WEIRDTHINGS at checkout and get 5 extra human teeth.
Wow. I'll tell you what.
Wow.
There's there's been sightings I'm just going to looking for the Wikipedia, the majority of American states. This paku fish is popular. People love this thing.
We got one here in New Jersey.
New Jersey.
But it's a dangerous looking fish, but if you know that it mostly eats plants, then you would feel safer having it.
Now, some people are saying that it's tasty in the chat. Like, how far does it being tasty get you?
No, food fish. Theodore Roosevelt wrote of catching and eating paku in his book, Through the Brazilian Wilderness. He described them as good-sized, deep-bodied fish and noted that they were delicious eating.
Today, the Amazon River is experiencing a crisis of overfishing. Both subsistence fishers and their commercial rivals compete in netting large quantities of paku, which bring good prices in Brazil and abroad. So apparently, comparable to that of hybrid striped bass, tilapia, and rainbow trout, but superior to catfish.
And by the way, look, apparently this nut biting thing is worldwide. There was one in the strait between Sweden and Denmark. Led to media reporting of warning that the fish could bite your nuts.
I mean, why would it want to do that?
Reason why there's a urban legend, the urban legend of the paku fish biting off testicles is...
Texticles. They've got the written word on them.
Never texticle.
Their teeth are strong enough to break tree nuts.
Oh.
Oh. Okay. They think so they're walnuts?
They actually eat tree nuts, but not your nuts.
Unless by accident.
Yeah, unless they decide to go nuts.
Unless your nuts are of the consistency and size of a tree nut.
By the way, that's one of the articles on the Modern Rogue this week was about counterfeits and double dipping. And one of the examples they gave is that apparently in parts of China, walnuts are popular both as, you know, the meat of the nut. You can have walnuts, right, to eat. But then also having walnuts as fidget spinners, basically, for you to mix around in your hand is like a good luck thing. Yeah, really, yeah, really. Kind of like Benoit balls, yeah. Right? And so some people figured out, like, well, why not both? So rather than crack the nuts and sell the meat or keep them whole – They would slice the nuts in half, sell the meat, and then put like newspaper and lead shot in there, glue them back together, and then sell them as the fidget spinner experience.
Walnuts.
Yeah.
Wow.
Lots of good articles over at that themodernrogue.com.
Interesting.
Modernrogue.com. Look at that.
Should check that out sometime. One last quick story here. In January of this year, January 23rd, I believe. There was a big earthquake in Alaska. Do you guys hear this? You hear about this? You see this?
Yep.
There were tsunami warnings. Thankfully, nothing too bad happened on that front. But what do you think is the furthest away a hurricane, an earthquake could affect geography?
Affect the geography, like initiated a landslide or something?
So, like the epicenter, I believe, was in Anchorage, in Alaska. How far away do you think that earthquake could affect the landscape?
The only thing my mental Rolodex is coming up with is I know that when Krakatoa exploded, there was a shockwave felt literally all the way around the world twice. Like it did laps. Like this thing exploded. There was like a rumble that went around the world, and then a second wave of the rumble again. So I'm going to guess, if you're talking about altering the geographic landscape, you know, knocking over trees and whatnot, what, through 3,000 miles as far away as what, Mexico?
Okay, that's about right.
Yeah, I would piggyback on that because I'm not great at spatial understanding.
So this is I think you got the distance close about right, but maybe the effects of this specific earthquake. This is a 7.9 earthquake.
7.9. Keep in mind, like that Richter scale, like every what 0.1 Richter is like 10 times more than the one before it. So like an 8.0 is 10 times bigger than a 7.9, right?
Yeah. In Florida, 3,800 miles away, the earthquake was so...
Andrew Maine was woken from his nap.
The earthquake was so powerful that it affected well water levels.
What? So it squeezed more water pressure into there?
It brought water levels up in Madison, Florida, and it brought water levels down in Fort Lauderdale.
They're stealing our water!
The frogs are turning gay
with no water.
I guess I could see that. So if you picture all of the water underground, like capillaries all throughout, and everything just sort of flexes, it makes sense that very minute change would squeeze water pressure, causing it to go way higher. Mm-hmm.
A water level rise from 41.59 feet to 41.77 feet was recorded at a well near Madison before it returned to normal. In Fort Lauderdale, the water level fell from 1.42 feet to 1.31 feet. The USGS says water levels in wells respond to seismic wave-induced expansion and contraction of the aquifer tapped by the well, in turn causing step or oscillatory fluid pressure changes. So basically, all that water is getting shook up. I think that's what they meant. That's the subtext.
I'm water.
That's crazy. I mean, that's something that I've kind of obviously had more appreciation for living out here than I did in Florida, is just how interconnected all the kind of like rumblings whenever there's any sort of earthquake or anything, and you realize kind of like where, how far away it is compared to the fact that like you just felt whatever you just did in your location. Like it's pretty crazy.
Have you had any scary earthquake experiences since you went to the West Coast?
Not really scary. The one that I always found the funniest was we had an earthquake and the birds started going nuts. It was in the middle of the night. And Ashley was so concerned about the birds that she opened up the cage and they were flying around and going crazy. And then when it was all done, she was like, man, like the birds had real night terror. And I'm like, I think it was probably the earthquake. She's like, what earthquake?
Yeah, did you not notice the ground rumbling?
And so I remember everything kind of moving, and she was just so concerned with the health and safety of the birds that it was just something that, you know, fell under whatever else, blinders, whatever else blocked out by the panic blinders.
Oh, it's amazing.
Apparently, some of in the past, some of these earthquakes have affected well water levels dramatically. In 1998, a 5.2 magnitude northwest Pennsylvania trembler, rendered dry about 120 wells locally for 3 months.
man, what a pisser, right? Like, you dig a well, and then all of a sudden, God picks up the diorama of your planet and just sort of shakes it, and then everything drains away, and you're like, oh, you got me again, you bearded guy.
My water. Another score plus one for Gaia.
And in Denali, Alaska, in 2002, a 7.9 magnitude earthquake caused a well in Wisconsin to rise 2 feet.
Maybe this is a controversial opinion, but I don't think that's okay. I think we should pass a law, no more earthquakes.
Oh.
Make them illegal. I mean, all these people saying and they should be regulated. Like, you think...
Yeah, we could tax them.
I mean, yeah, exactly, right? There should be an earthquake tax.
What is the crust of the earth supposed to do?
It's supposed to cough up that gold. We know it's sitting on billions of precious metals.
Hey, Mr. Tectonic. Why don't you go ahead and cough up that hidden gold you have?
It's me, Tectonic, your number one field liaison for coastal commerce with the planet Earth.
And also one very specific cocktail. But, like, if we don't have earthquakes, then we'd probably have a lot of volcanoes.
You know what? Tax them, too. I don't understand. I mean, they got gold in them lavas. Come on.
Why aren't you giving us the gold instead only lava?
All right, well, that does it for stories. Do you guys want to do some picks?
Yeah, I do. Yeah,
no journey quest, obviously, without our journey master. So I got a pick. I started watching a show the other day, and it's called The Handmaid's Tale.
Oh, so you feel like with joy and optimism about the world around you? You just feel like you took a sweet vacation in a wonderful spot?
Let me see. Or Handmaid's Tale, not Handmaid.
Yeah. On Hulu.
Sale. So I don't know. How many are there? So there are, what, 10 episodes?
I think it's about 10.
There's 10 heartbreaks, as they call them.
So I'm at episode
10 opportunities to regret being part of humanity. 10,
I'm at
10,
episode
10 regret. They call them the 10 regrets. Just you're just like, if you just want to feel miserable.
You regretted watching The Handmaid's Tale?
No, it was very challenging for me because it was not a fun place to visit. And it's like everything about that, by the end, there's a hint of a revolution or whatever. Yeah. But it's like, man, it's not a fun place to visit for me, and it's artistic and beautiful and amazing and incredible and engaging, hypnotic, all the good things that come with good art. Also, not a place I'm happy with.
I mean, it's not resolved.
Correct.
You know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're gonna get a season two, so I don't know where season one ends, but you know what was amazing to me was watching it as the amalgamation of so much other popular art. Like, you kind of realize how much of it a show of its time it is. Like, it has the dystopian elements of The Hunger Games, and it has the a woman making her way through an unjust society, like, you know, reminiscent of Elizabeth or Elizabeth Moss's other character in Mad Men. And it has the flashback. I mean, some of the flashbacks are almost like right out of Lost in terms of having these like stories from back in the olden times reflect to where we are now.
And also like this unrelenting, like it's on you to keep up with whether this is a now thing or a previous thing. They don't do simple tricks like change the color palette to indicate if this is the past, the future, or the current or whatever. Instead, it's just like, much like a book, you're just dropped in there and it's for you to figure out from context clues when this happened.
So I was not familiar with the book before I watched the series, but I'm curious to read it. If just because I wonder if when they were making it, they put any consideration to making it a period piece. So like now the show itself seems to be, you know, we're given context clues that this is 5 years from present day. So we're in present day now. When this theocracy is kind of set up, and it was 5 or 6 years ago when everything started to kind of, you know, go the way that it wound up going. And I wonder whether or not there was a thought to kind of make it, because it came out in 1985, to make it more an early 80s story that then went 6 years in the future. So now we're in like an alternate 1995 or 1991 or something like that, because there is the only part of the world building for the dystopian future that I find that I found hard to challenging to kind of wrap my head around was kind of how quickly that revolution comes, specifically. Like, it would have, I guess it just would have made more sense as a mid-80s story when, like, you're only, you know, if you wanted to take over America, you'd really only have to shut down 4 broadcast networks and, like, 3 newspaper syndicates, and you would effectively control all media. Whereas now, when it, all of a sudden somebody turns the revolution switch, and now all of a sudden all these mechanisms are coming into place to control the populace, it just kind of seems a little weird in a era where, like, now when a New York Times article on Twitter, before it even goes into print, right, can cause demonstrations in the streets, you know?
Yeah, sure, sure.
But other than that, you know, we'll see how we get to the end. I think that the stuff that gets right, it gets really, really right. The stuff that can get a little tedious has kind of gotten a little.
How far through the 10 episodes are you?
We just watched 8, so I think we have 9 and 10 to go. But we've fully kind of gotten into the palace intrigue portion. You know, we've kind of come out of the this world. What is this world? And now it's you know, our characters are playing the game.
Yeah, the season ends with a good amount of momentum. Like, It'll be interesting to see where it goes from the start of season 2, because you get a real, like, all right, we're doing something.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess there is just kind of a question with that sort of fiction in general, which is, what do you do, like, the Hunger Games, for whatever it was never really, like, you kind of just, you have to come to the problem of, do we just keep inventing reasons to put our main characters in the Hunger Games? Right? Or do we tell this wider story of revolution and change and control and all that stuff? And ultimately, that's where Hunger Games goes, spoiler alert. Whereas, you know, I think that the question for this show is like, okay, well, what is the more interesting story for us to tell? Is it our main character becoming more powerful in this awful dystopic kind of world, or is it this dystopic theocracy coming down?
Yeah.
I look forward to seeing it.
Cool. Brad, do you have a pick?
Dude, I'm going to toot my own horn, because we are now 2 weeks into this wonderful experiment, a.k.a. the Modern Rogue articles. If you go to themodernrogue.com, you'll see that we have new articles every weekday by some of the top writers. It's no big secret that a few months back, Cracked.com has, for the better part of a decade, been one of my favorite sources for really smart articles that give you some good enlightening takeaways, but then also mix in funny jokes and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I've always wanted the Modern Rogue to sort of grow into that space. Once all of a sudden everybody got fired, it was like, well, let's see what we can make happen. And so we were working with John Cheese, who's now editor in chief over there. And every one of these articles, my favorite thing is, like, if it's 5 new ways to smuggle things that sound insane, and then, like, I finish the article, I'm like, I had never heard of all 5 of these. Has me really, really excited about where stuff is headed on there. Please check out themodernrogue.com. We got RSS feeds on there so that you can get daily content, and I think you're really going to enjoy it.
Yeah, very cool.
And follow the Twitter account, right? Because the Twitter account will get you all the new stuff as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's at Modern Rogue Show, and I think that's also it on Instagram. I have a pick. It's been a while since I read it, but I saw it the other day, and I was reminded how much I liked it. It's called Sacred Heart by Liz Suburbia. It's a, I think it's, it started off as a webcomic, but you can get it as a, you can get the full story as like a, what is it, a trade, basically, on Kindle and on paperback. And it's a really interesting premise of what does a town that is only inhabited by teenagers and children do? Like, what story do you tell in this one very specific place? You know, they still are going to school, kinda, and they're having parties and taking care of themselves, but also still have like romance and sexuality stuff. Like, it's really fascinating to set to like try to tap into these like traditional ideas of teenage and coming of age stories in a setting that is that is like both like mysterious and completely understood. You know, it's not until the very end where you actually get an idea of why there are no parents in this town, and it's perfect and it's completely unexpected. And it's really cool. I would really recommend you check out Sacred Heart from Liz Suburbia.
Awesome.
Thank you guys for joining us for the Weird Things podcast again.
Yeah.
It's been weird.
Dr. Racist.
Oops.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.